The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Coming up this hour, what do we make of the survey in which more Americans say violence against the government can be justified? And then we're joined by our friend and author, David French. You're listening to The Common Good. Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Alongside Aubrey Sampson, my name is Brian Fromm. Happy Tuesday. Glad that you're with us today. And hope that all is going well. Aubrey, my kids back at school today. Yours have been. So life, holidays are behind us now. It is over.
So sad. I feel like I'm grieving a little bit, but that's okay. That's okay. There's something to look forward to every day.
On the way to school today, driving my oldest daughter to school, we counted the number of Christmas trees discarded on the side of the road.
Oh, gosh. That's funny.
It was something to be said. Speaking of the road and speaking of this, Aubrey, I saw this story. And as I was reading, I watched it on the Today Show, but I also was just reading about it on Twitter and stuff. And I thought to myself that, you know, you've got like Dante's Inferno where you have your levels of hell, right?
Right.
This one is high up there. Did you see this story about the traffic jam in Virginia? For those who didn't see it this morning, it says drivers along a 50-mile stretch of I-95 in Virginia, which is a huge like thing that people take, right?
Like a major interstate, right?
They have been stranded in freezing temperatures for hours after a crash involving multiple vehicles brought the roadway to a standstill and the first mid-Atlantic snowstorm of the year dumped more than a foot of snow on the region. So there's a couple stories here, including U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, who said, I started my normal two-hour drive to D.C. at 1 p.m. yesterday. 19 hours later, I'm still not near the Capitol. 19 hours.
Unbelievable.
The story goes on to talk about very specific stories where people have been not – their cars have not moved. This was this morning.
Had not moved
for 12 hours.
No.
They've gone all night. You've got kids. You've got pets. You've got people running out of gas. You've got people with no food. All this stuff. I read this.
Awful. And it's freezing cold outside. This is terrible.
Snowstorm in the midst of it. And some people tried to have fun with it. They're apparently like a flash mob started of people dancing, but other people are just like, no, I am terrified.
Yeah, it's awful.
I don't know what to do. And they're just stuck. I read this. Sometimes you read things and you're like, this feels like the absolute worst thing that could ever happen. That's one of those circumstances. I could not believe this.
I would have abandoned my vehicle and not looked back. Like, I just would have been like, I mean, you know, this car has been good to me. I'm glad that I had it for a while. I don't care what happens to it. I'm out. And I would have walked through the snow, through the highway, through the cars to somewhere. Like, what a nightmare. And at that point, it's not like people can come get you because it's so packed. And it's not like at some point your cell phone probably dies. I mean, and then thinking about your car dying and just being in the frigid weather. I mean, even just like, what if you have to go to the bathroom? Like these basic things. And if you have kids in the car with you,
that.
No, I would have lost my mind.
One of the stranded people said to the Today Show, for the last 7+ hours, I've been stuck in my car, not moving in a total shutdown about 30 miles south of D.C. So anyway, I haven't seen an update, but I just can't imagine this because, as you said, they say cars are just littered. It's littered with people who've abandoned their cars. And people who've just given up. So when I saw that, I said, I need to talk about this because that feels like, you know what? We often think we're in control of everything. Aubrey, we say this a lot on this show. Another example of, you know what? You're just not in control of everything.
I mean, you just absolutely aren't. Because obviously people started out that day just thinking it was going to be a normal day, maybe knowing they'd have some rough roads, but you'd have no idea you're going to be stuck for over 19 hours yeah. in your car.
Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
So I wanted to start with that craziness. It's weird. My family yesterday, this totally, maybe this will connect. We, for their, my kids' last day of Christmas break, we went and did an escape room. My family.
Oh,
did.
How was that? Was it fun?
Oh, it was so fun. And we came so close to actually making it, but we didn't make it.
Oh, sad.
But there does come these points in these escape rooms where you're like, am I ever getting out of this thing? And that's what I thought of when I was reading this story. Yeah.
That's like a real life escape room.
It is. And our producer makes a good point. Maybe a good idea to pack some food and water in our cars to make sure you got your phone charger.
Get blankets, get light flashlights. Like this time of year, you have to travel. My mom says you should even travel with candles just in case.
See, your mom's thinking. Your mom's
thinking.
Yeah,
she's always ahead of the game.
Now, another thing we like to do on the show, I'm gonna hit the all fields here in the first couple minutes.
All right, let's go.
What is wrong with our society? Are you ready? Another example, Aubrey, of what is wrong with our culture?
Oh, I don't even know if I want to hear it, but here we go. Tell me.
Betty White's agent says her death, quote, should not be politicized after false vaccine claims. So there started to be an internet rumor yesterday that Betty White got the COVID-19 vaccine two or three days before her death. And as you can imagine, there were many people online who decided to use Betty White's death as the talking point for why the vaccine should not be administered, why it's dangerous. You shouldn't get the vaccine.
Come
it's actually killing people.
On.
To the point that her friends and her agent had to come out in their time of grieving and say, she didn't just get the vaccine. She died of natural causes. She's 99 years old. Can we please not politicize her? Aubrey, if we're going to politicize the death of Betty White, I feel like nothing is off limits for politicization.
Nothing is sacred
right now.
Anymore. Like, this actually makes me want to cry. I'm not sure why. This feels like it hits so much harder than other things. Like, this woman was 99 years old. Can we just pause?
Yes.
Let her family and her friends grieve, celebrate her life. Done. And nothing else. Like, and that's it. Like our humanity has just like fallen apart. I mean, this is beyond even just like kindness. This has become vicious and disgusting. This is gross. I agree. Do not politicize anyone's death, but especially when these are just false claims. Like that's the part that's so layered in yuckiness.
That's a good way to put it. We're going to leave it at that. Yuckiness. Yes, yes. All right, Aubrey, one more.
Oh,
I'm
no.
I'm trying to paint a picture of what's going on in our culture. This is
right,
from Bloomberg.
Right,
this is from Bloomberg. New poll says more Americans say violence against government can be justified. 1 in 3 Americans say violence against the government can at times be justified. A poll by the Washington Post and the University of Maryland found almost a year after the attack on the U.S. Capitol. The poll's findings were detailed Sunday in the Post, which said the share of respondents with that view, here's the important part, was the highest in similar polls spanning the last 2 decades. The article said the percentage of adults who said violence could be justified had risen from 23% in 2015 and only 16% in 2010. The poll said that the share of people in the latest poll that said violence against the government was never justified was 62%. That compares with as many as 90% in the 90s. So, Aubrey, there is a change. It breaks down between Republicans and Democrats. And it's not that as big a difference as you would expect.
Okay.
It breaks down between black and white. But just the headline there, Aubrey, the poll is showing for the highest level in 2 decades saying that violence against the government can be justified.
Is the world just ending? Like, is that what's happening?
That's what I tried to do to you today.
I don't know. I think I need to just sit out now, Brian. I think you got to take over the show.
I broke your brain.
I always think we should stand up against corrupt political leaders. Like,
sure.
I think that's a beautiful part about America is we have the right, we have the ability to do that. But peacefully. Like, at this point, I'm not even saying respectfully, just peacefully. Violence is never justifiable, ever. Like, we've seen that proven throughout history. Like, violence is not a means to an end. And I understand that sometimes it can get things done. But this is how, by the way, we're almost at the anniversary of January 6th. This is how things like January 6th happen. Mm-hmm. And I feel like these are the things that you watch in other countries and you go, oh, I'm so glad that could never happen in America. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, wait a second. I understand anger towards the government. I understand anger towards leaders, but there are healthy ways, like adults, we know this. There are healthy ways to express our anger, to make change that are not violence oriented, period.
Yeah.
Maybe I sound like a Pollyanna, but I have nothing. I mean, I don't even know how to justify this. What do you think, Brian?
I'm just glad I broke your brain. But secondly, I would say this. I would say here, you might be out there going, well, of course, if there's a, you know, the people have to rise up. And I would say, just be careful. What I think requires violence against the government and what you think and what that person thinks may be altogether different. And that's going to then get out of hand. So I agree with what you said, like, especially as Christ followers, like, yes, we want to make changes and we want to protest and we want to stand up for what's right. But
right.
I'm not sure that this trajectory is good, that more and more people are going, yeah, violence is can be justified, because that's going to lead us to bad places. Well, that's what I wanted to do to start here. I wanted to dump a bunch of things on you.
Thanks, Brian.
Successfully get you off the rails. And with that in mind, we got a friend coming up next, somebody that we highly respect. He wrote recently an article called The Places Where Truth Goes to Die. His name is David French, and we're excited to be joined by David next here on The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life, alongside Aubrey Sampson. My name is Brian Fromm, and Aubrey and I are thrilled to be joined again by the senior editor at The Dispatch, co-host of the Good Faith podcast, author of Divided We Fall. He's our friend David French. David, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, we love having you on, man. So thanks for spending the time. David, we've got lots of things we want to talk to you about. I want to start here. Yesterday, Aubrey and I came back from our long Christmas break, and we were hoping the first thing we weren't going to have to talk about was COVID, but here we go. Here it is again. And I know you just went through some bout with COVID kind of coming out. What do you make of the resurgence of COVID? Because I hear some people going, hey, this is a good thing. This variant's not so bad. It's going to kind of go through. Maybe this will get us to the end, and other people are ready to shut the world down again. How are you processing what's going on around us right now?
Yeah, you know, the way I'm looking at it is it seems the best available data seems to indicate that this new variant is A, really contagious. Mm-hmm. I can testify to that firsthand. But B, it's not the same as some of the variants that we've seen before, that it isn't as severe. And fortunately, when it went through our family, that was the case. We're all vaccinated. I'm boosted. And I think I had it the worst, and I had about 3 to 4 days where I felt really pretty poorly. Mm. But at no point did I ever feel like I was in danger. At no point did I ever feel like I was battling something that was truly serious. You know, there are people I've known that I went to college with who have died from COVID, who their symptoms, even from the beginning, and people who've had COVID and recovered, their symptoms, even from the beginning, were substantially different and in most instances, substantially more serious. So it looks to me like the available data says highly contagious, less severe. Mm-hmm. And if that's the situation, there's a possibility here that, and look, I'm no epidemiologist, but right. The people that I've been listening to who've been most consistently correct through this process, because we've all been learning, everybody's been learning.
Yes.
But the people who have been most consistently correct have been saying, look, this could be, knock on wood, maybe possibly the beginning of the end, because this is going to be the point where the disease, it can be dangerous, and it's when you catch it, it's still for a lot of folks, it can still be a pretty rough week. But this could be the stage where we really get that kind of a combination of vaccination and natural immunity and less severity that means it doesn't cripple us anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, I certainly think all of us are kind of praying, crossing our fingers, holding our breath, that is true. But glad to hear you and your family are doing okay, David. That's good news. So I want to take a little sharp turn here and go back to something that you wrote over at the Dispatch in December, "The Wounds Politics Cannot Heal." And you write, "Politics is a false god and a weak God as well. I feel like that's such a powerful subtitle. Can you talk to us a little bit about that article?
Yeah, you know what? I was reflecting because we're beginning to get a lot of data about that Americans are just becoming, especially Americans who don't have a college degree, are becoming substantially more lonely and disconnected. For example, Americans without a college education experienced a very large decline of close friends, which is about as intimate as you can get as far as this idea of connections in our lives, that college-educated Americans are substantially less active in their communities. Americans without a college education are much less likely to be involved in a religious organization or a member of a religious organization, a church, a synagogue, or a mosque. And so what we're beginning to have is a big population of Americans who are just disconnected from others. They're disconnected from these close relationships. And what we're also beginning to see at the same time, and this isn't just Americans with or without college educations, but Americans of all classes are beginning to feel, and you know, it wasn't just Americans without a college education who were experiencing declines in these areas. It's all more pronounced with them, but all areas, classes of Americans are experiencing these declines. And what's happening is you're beginning to see there are millions of Americans who are filling that hole in their hearts, that lack of connection, that lack of involvement in the community, that lack of membership in a church or a synagogue or a mosque. They're beginning to fill that with politics. And they're beginning to fill that with political zeal. And what I was saying is that politics is a very, very, very poor substitute for the kinds of connections and the kinds of, and the sense of purpose and meaning you gain from these other institutions.
Yeah. I guess the $64,000 question, David, is why? Why are people not as connected? It seems like the opportunities for connection are more than they used to be. So why are people more disconnected, and why is politics an easy one for people that to seem to turn to?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. One of the reason is, and I think a lot of it is sort of chicken and egg as well. I think that the fracturing of the family, the fracturing of the nuclear family, has effects beyond. So, for example, when you have a fracturing of the nuclear family, that also often means fracturing in the extended family. And so, you know, an extended family, the brothers and sisters and the aunts and uncles, you can kind of absorb if one of the marriages collapses or if two of the marriages collapses in this sort of big extended family. But if you begin to see marital collapse up and down the line, then you have people who are cut off from that closest relationship, cut off from those friendships, and cut off from, you know, each other in a very, very dramatic way. I also think that, the way in which we live and interact with each other, the prominence of technology in our lives, that gives us an ability to form a facsimile of a friendship. Often friendships sort of centered around common interests. And, you know, we're both Memphis Grizzlies fans, you know, hottest team in the NBA, or we all love Donald Trump a ton, or we're deeply committed to this cause or that cause. But these are thinner friendships because they're conditioned on the faction you belong to. A friendship formed at a Trump rally, for example, isn't necessarily going to survive if you decide you don't support Donald Trump any longer. That's sort of the foundational element of it. Whereas deeper, richer friendships can persist through a host of differences.
One of the things that you write in this article, which I love, is this is where the church itself, because it is a family and because it is a fundamental part, not just a story of hope, but the story of hope, is indispensable and irreplaceable. And I do feel like, you know, we've also seen that church attendance because of COVID or even because of politics has gone way, way down. And I wonder, David, what do we do? I mean, I know that that's a broad question, but just how do we begin, I guess, to re-engage people who are far away from church? How do we begin to invite them back in? And how do we, as people who maybe feel disengaged ourselves, take steps toward the church again?
Well, you know, I think it's the first thing you have to do is you sort of have to say, okay, I amidst all of the friendships that are fracturing and the relationships that are falling apart in these really divisive times, I cannot be part of that problem also. And so going back years, I made this decision. I said, okay, a friendship is not going to fall apart. I'm not going to end a friendship over politics. If somebody's going to end it with me, I have no control over that. They're going to do what they're going to do, but I'm not going to end relationships over politics. And I'm not going to end relationships over these kinds of disagreements. And that doesn't mean I left the public square, obviously.
Yeah.
But what you're trying to do in your individual relationships, I think, is see people as human beings created in the image of God, wonderful and flawed at the same time, and that we can see what's deeper and more profoundly important about them than the thing that irritates us about them. And that's, you know, often very difficult, especially in a culture that sort of doesn't have, you know, remind me of the, you know, Jesus said, forgive 70 times seven. We don't even have a three strikes and you're out policy anymore. Yeah. It's a one strike and that tells me all I need to know about you. And we're really sort of becoming captured by that culture that's a one strike and you're out. And we can't live like that. We can't live like that. And so I think part of it is decide not to become a part of the problem yourself. And then when you made that decision, look, this becomes a very individual, localized kind of thing where you, you know, you're determined to reach out towards those people in your own circle who you see are hurting or isolated or cut off.
Such a good word from David French. Again, senior editor at The Dispatch, co-host of the Good Faith podcast. David, this week is, it's a heavy day, right? It's a year. We all remember where we were a year ago on January the 6th. And I know they're still in, you know, the committee still going on and all of this stuff. But how would you tell our people, our listeners, how should we be thinking this week as we come to January 6th? How do we memorialize it? What have we learned about ourselves since that day? How are you going to remember and kind of memorialize January 6th this week?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I think is really important is for people to continue to pay attention to the developments. And when you continue to pay attention to the developments and what we've learned about January 6th, and really what we've learned about all of the days leading up to January 6th, we don't, and I don't want to be too alarmist, but I've started to think of January 6th as our nation's near-death day. And here's the reason why I say that. Because there was a plan in place on January 6th to completely disrupt the outcome of an American presidential election. And if Mike Pence had said yes to this plan and all of the pressure was on him,
that's right.
He had legal arguments saying that he should do it. He had a president telling him he should do it. He had presidential advisors telling him he should do it. There was a giant mob outside of the Capitol chanting at him, threatening his life. If he had given in, if he had done it and given in on that day, you know, one of the things at The Dispatch we've thought about doing is doing a podcast where we sort of role play out in game scenario out. What would have happened if he'd done what the Eastman memo asked him to do? And it is, it gets very terrifying very fast.
Wow.
And you can easily imagine a situation where by just 2 weeks later, you know, on the 20th, two different presidents take the oath of office. And you could easily imagine that scenario if Pence had said yes.
Wow.
And if that ended up happening, how does our nation decide? And does our nation decide in a way, decide that peacefully? So that's the reason why I say history will record that there was an enormous, that quite literally, the weight of the nation was on Pence's shoulders on that day. That wasn't just some sort of mob trespassing. That was part of a plan that was supposed to culminate in Mike Pence taking steps to overturn an election.
Wow. Wow. You know, what's interesting, earlier in the show today, Brian and I covered an article over at Bloomberg.com. They reported that more Americans say violence against the government can be justified. And, you know, what's interesting thinking about the interpretation of January 6th last year is that there are still so many people saying that was justifiable violence or that wasn't even violence. And I don't really know how to make sense of that. I'm not sure any of us do. But I wonder, David, you talked about looking back on this day in history. Do you think there will be lessons learned from it?
I hope so. You know, look, one thing that we have to understand is that this is not, and it's only really a minority of Americans who are going to pay close attention to, because people move on. They start to think about like inflation, or they think about, you know, other things, the Omicron variant, for example. I mean, there's a lot going on in people's lives, but it's still vitally important that as many Americans as possible focus on this and think hard about how we can avoid this and keep this from ever happening again.
Yeah.
And you know, look, one of the things that I think is incredibly important in analyzing this is that the people who stormed the Capitol building believed they were defending democracy. They had been completely lost in a giant lie.
Yeah.
And if you think that an election had been stolen and was being stolen, and you keep saying that to people, if you keep saying an election was corruptly stolen, some people are going to act like that's the case, and they're going to, if not take up arms, they're going to start a riot. And so, you know, one of the things I think is going to be incredibly important going forward is eliminating some of these pressure points and vulnerabilities, like fixing the Electoral Count Act. And, you know, look, some of these defamation lawsuits that are trying to impose a cost on the chief liars that launched this election lie, I think it's important that they succeed.
Mm.
Yeah.
David, over at the French Press, at the Dispatch, I want to make sure to highlight this one blog post that you wrote, The Places Where Truth Goes to Die, because I think that plays into what we're talking about here and all of this. So it's a great blog and article. I would encourage people to go read it. Let me just read one paragraph you wrote. You wrote, one way that truth dies is that when we place such exacting preconditions on its delivery into our lives that there is virtually no messenger or message that can penetrate our hearts. We see that going on around us all the time. Can you unpack that a little bit about how the messenger and the message and what you're talking about here?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you see this and start to notice this, you can't unsee it. And that is, the way in which people will dismiss even truthful messages and dismiss even the truth. Well, for example, they say, well, I don't read anything that comes from the fake news New York Times, or I'm not going to listen to anything from a never Trumper, or you're just saying that because you want to curry favor with the elite, or you don't have the right motive in speaking to me, or you said that in a way that's condescending, or you said that in a way that was elitist. So in other words, there was something about the way you said it that was off-putting. Or maybe, you know, you're launching it at the wrong target. Why are you talking about January 6th when you should be talking about the riots that were in the cities on the, you know, throughout the whole summer? Or why are you talking about Donald Trump? Did you believe the same things about Bill Clinton? And so what ends up happening is you end up saying, okay, I'm going to only hear things from a right person who's using exactly the right tone and attacking exactly the right target with purest of possible motives. And once you begin to screen people out like that, who are you even listening to?
Right. There's no one to listen to.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Which doesn't mean, by the way, that you don't try to speak with the right tone.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you just, you know, as I use this term, I said, it's not like you as a communicator, my job isn't to like fly over the target and dump truth bombs like I'm a B-52 over Hanoi.
That's right.
That's good.
It's a reciprocal responsibility. I should try hard to try to communicate in a way and with words that people will understand. At the same time, as a listener, I need to be open. And I need to, you know, some of the harshest, as I wrote in, some of the harshest words spoken to me have turned out to be the most true. And I've really learned important lessons from unlikely teachers. So I should be open.
Such a good word. It's called The Places Where Truth Goes to Die. You could go get it at The Dispatch. Go to thedispatch.com. That is thedispatch.com. Also connect with David on Twitter at David A. French. That's at David A. French. David, we're always thrilled when you're coming on, man. Thanks so much for spending the time.
You.
And we're glad you're on the other side of COVID and doing better, man. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Common Good here on AIM 1160. Hope for your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Common Good. My name is Aubrey Sampson alongside my co-host, Brian Fromm. And Brian, you and I heard a story that we were deeply moved by, the story of Sarah DeBerry. She was injured when she was just 8 years old. She dashed across the street towards an ice cream shop, and she was hit by a car, suffering a major trauma. She was paralyzed and in a coma for 8 days. Her parents thought she wasn't going to make it. If she made it, she'd never do anything with her life. But an incredible part of her story is that Sarah saw a huge light after her accident, and someone she calls maybe a guardian angel, but someone told her it wasn't her time yet. And she has grown into someone who is doing incredible things. She has like 7 jobs and she's writing books. We're going to talk to her about her book in just a few minutes, a book called My Second Chance at Life that's available on Amazon right now. And I mean, beyond the story itself, Brian, I love that her heart is really about, look, there are people in this world who speak differently because of brain injuries or trauma or just because of situations at birth. They look different. They are different. Mm-hmm. Can we treat everyone with kindness and dignity? And I just feel like this is a very common good story and a story really of what it looks like to treat everyone with the respect simply because they're created in the image of God.
Mm. Yeah, it's an inspiring story. I'm just reading through some of her quotes from it where she talks about making a deal with God before surgery for brain stimulation, coming to grips with I'm not going to get any better and I'm okay with that. Being different is special. But I know that I'm strong. She talks about where she finds her peace. And Aubrey, I just think it's such an important one because, you know, not all of us, obviously, this is going to be a really obvious statement. Most of us are not going to deal with this sort of trauma in our lives and these sort of obstacles. But we can take from her going through these huge obstacles and go, man, what can I learn from this when I go through obstacles in my own life? When I feel like there's, you know, things aren't going like they should, or I have no hope or whatever else. This is a woman who has persevered. She's written a book. She is advocating, and she was at a point where her parents were told she's not going to live.
Right.
And when you hear her, you know, it's a struggle. But I think what she's doing with her life in the midst of that struggle is just inspiring because so many of us, we come up against much smaller obstacles and we go, I don't want to go any further. And we shake our fist at God and we say, it's not worth it or whatever else it might be. And she has been through legitimate life altering, struggle inducing trauma. And she's like, you know what? This is who I am. I'm different. I'm at peace. Write a book. I'm going to advocate.
Yes.
I'm going to work. I'm going to make the best of this. And that's exactly what she does. And it's great. It's great.
Here's something else I love. This was written about her in her book. It says, DeBerry has a firm grasp on who she is and what she can accomplish. Here's a quote from Sarah herself. I don't give up easily. God recreated me for a reason. Even though I have a crazy arm, that's her language. Even though I have a crazy arm and messed up speech, I wouldn't change a thing because that's how God wants me to be. And her book, My Second Chance at Life, and you'll hear in our conversation in just a moment, just some powerful insights that all people, whether like you said, Brian, you've been through something really traumatic or you're just struggling with difficulty in life, she has a message of encouragement for all of us. I just think the fact that she is like, she has 7 jobs and has a college degree and is writing books. Like, this to me is a life well lived for sure.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that for that reason, it's to be challenged by and to be inspired by. So it's just hard because a lot of us live, if God treats me well, then I'll serve him. If we do this, then that. You know, you think of, and Aubrey, it's one of the things I've enjoyed about the show is I think we keep going back to God is still present. God hasn't given up on you. And there's coming a day where these things are not our reality. And so I think we can hold on to that. And that's why we wanted to talk to her, because her story is inspiring.
And I think, Brian, for our listeners and even for you and I, you know, we've had Vinitha Reisner on the show, who's talked about some of her suffering. We've talked about Joni Erickson Tada on the show before. And now we've got another person, Sarah DeBerry, who really has developed deep, deep resilience in times of suffering and in times when other of, like, we would look upon some of these lives and go, this is too much. I couldn't handle it. But these incredible women have developed such resiliency to survive, and not just survive, but to thrive. And I think you're exactly right. Like, when we hear, we're going to listen to our conversation with Sarah here in just a minute. There's just lessons for all of us. Brian, does any just one lesson come to mind?
From her, I think it is, you still have a purpose. We hear this from people all the time who've gone through traumatic. When they realize, I still have a purpose, God is still at work in my life. When she got hit by that car, her purpose didn't cease to exist. Her life got more complicated and difficult, but she still has a purpose. God is still using her powerfully. And you can hear her. She leans into that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, with that in mind, let's go ahead and take a listen to part of Brian and my conversation with author Sarah DeBerry. Sarah, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your story? We know your book is about the injury and how you've learned to have this second chance at life. Can you tell us what happened?
When I was about 8 years old, I was with my twin sister and one of my friends. Well, I ran across the street and a car hit me. I flew about 50 feet in the air, hit the cement, cracked my head open, then had to transport me by ambulance to the hospital. Well, about an hour after being at the hospital, my condition was not improving, so they decided to notify me to Children's Hospital Oakland and actually died. I was dead for over a minute, and they had to bring me back.
Sarah, thank you for sharing your story. Tell us about your life now. What are the challenges that you face, and just what are you doing in life right now?
Well, I have 7 different jobs, and the hardest thing for me is my feet, and I have what's called hemidystonia, where I can't control the left side of my body. So it's very hard for me, but I've learned to work around it.
You're so inspiring, the fact that you have 7 jobs and you're dealing with so much. What gives you the strength to persevere?
After the accident, I was made fun of so much because of how I looked, and some of my teachers, one of my where people teach and they have brain injury, or they have epilepsy, or they, you know, talk different or look different. It does not mean a bad person. It just means they're different.
And Sarah, tell us about what you're going to do with the rest of your life. What are the plans? What are your hopes and dreams?
My hopes and dreams are to continue to explore the world.
Sarah, it has been such a joy to be with you here today on The Common Good. We're so inspired by all that you're doing. I want to let our listeners know that they can purchase your book, My Second Chance at Life, on Amazon. It's available at other book retailers as well. And you will donate 10% of proceeds for each book sold to the hospital that saved your life. That is Children's Hospital of Oakland, California. Again, the book is called My Second Chance at Life by Sarah DeBerry, available on Amazon. Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Common Good on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Common Good. My name is Aubrey Sampson alongside my co-host, Brian Fromm. We are so thrilled that you're with us today. Brian, this month is both of our wedding anniversaries.
Yes, it is.
Not together, obviously.
Nope.
But Kevin and I are going to celebrate our 21st anniversary on January 6th. So coming up here in just a couple days. And you guys are celebrating your 22nd?
Yeah, right. I mean, Carrie and I graduated 1 year ahead of you and Kevin at Wheaton, and it sounds like we both got married. We all got married this January after graduation. Is
yeah,
what it
that's
sounds
exactly
like.
Right.
And so, yeah, we are 1 year ahead of you. So we are. This is our 22nd anniversary coming up, and so yeah, real excited. And can we just pause? My son was born on 9/11, so he always has to live with that. Now that your anniversary is on January 6th, do you feel like it has changed since last year? Like now that you have to put up with a little bit?
You know, I always loved our anniversaries on Epiphany in the traditional church calendar, and now it's like Insurrection Day. I feel yes. so sad about this. I felt like last year, oh, this won't be a big deal. Like, this won't mark it forever. But, you know, we interviewed David French earlier, and he said it was like near death day of America. So I'm like, well, okay, great. We're going to have to redeem it with our wedding, our marriage celebration, I guess. That's all there is to it. Well, Brian, I bring up the topic of marriage, you know, because anytime you hear of as someone who's kind of big in Christianity, whatever that means, they have a big platform in Christianity, and you hear sad things about their marriage, I think it's always worth pausing to pray for them and to honor the pain that this particular couple is in, but then also kind of learn like how do we recover from betrayal in marriage and in friendship? And I'm speaking specifically about Lisa Turkhurst. We don't need to spend a lot of time talking about her, but you know, she's the founder of Proverbs 31 Ministry, which is an explosive ministry for women. And she and her husband have had marriage problems for a long time because they're both public on this. He's really been a chronic cheater. They renewed their wedding vows about 3 years ago after beginning the process of divorce. And it looks like once again, and she put this publicly, he has not honored those vows. And so she's finally decided after 29 years that the better decision for her is to walk away. And she has biblical grounds for it. I don't think anyone is questioning, should she or shouldn't she? She is doing the right thing. But it, you know, it's so devastating anytime you hear a story of a marriage falling apart. But then you add the layer of a marriage falling apart in such a public way. And then you add another layer of a marriage falling apart for someone who runs a thriving ministry. Like, you just know the enemy is having a heyday there.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, this, I don't want to have any type of conversation judging them. I know you don't either, Brian. I think what I really wanted to talk about is a couple things. One, when do we know like it's time to move on? And then when is restoration possible? And I know you can't necessarily make a rule for everyone, but Brian, as a pastor, if people come to you with just marriage pain, how do you even begin to guide them?
Yeah, that's really hard, Aubrey, because I what I want the answer to your question to be is outside of just abuse, outside of, you know, danger or whatever else it might be. I want to say, like, my heart wants to say, to answer your question, it's never the right time to break up or to bail. And I understand that's a little Pollyanna for some people. And thankfully, my wife and I have never gone through, you know, just that depths of despair. But I will say marriage is hard sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know that if divorce is something that's on the table, then it becomes an option. And yeah, so right, therefore, right, you kind of want to keep that off. Now, what Lisa Turkhurst has dealt with here is kind of a, not kind of, it is a different ballgame. It's a different scenario. Work has been done and it's been different. And, you know, shame on those people who kind of peddle in Christian gossip and Christian kind of this to like have, you know, kind of talking about what her, because she's prominent, as you said, quote unquote. But, you know, Aubrey, I want to try to help marriages be restored as much as possible when there's abuse, when there's other things. Obviously, that's a different conversation. But is that too Pollyanna of me? What do you think? How would you answer that question?
You know, I'm with you, Brian. I feel like, okay, betrayal, sexual betrayal, marriage bed betrayal, especially chronic. Yeah. Like you have biblical grounds to leave. I think you're exactly right. If you're in danger, if there's abuse, you have biblical grounds to leave. I mean, there are moments scripturally when it is okay and it's better for you. But I am also with you. Like I want to see married couples thrive. And what I think you and I would just both agree on is what you said, marriage is hard. And so mm-hmm. just because marriage is hard, that's not a grounds for divorce. Yeah, so there are certainly categories when you and I as pastors would say, yes, run the other direction. It is time to end this thing. But I think in our biggest goal for the marriages in our church and for those we pastor would be, look, just because it's difficult or just because you're not compatible on paper or just because you've, quote, fallen out of love, those are not reasons to get a divorce. Those are not reasons to walk away. In fact, you and I think would say, like, lean in, get therapy, do the work to make the marriage of your dreams.
Yeah. And I would say to people is the vast majority of the time, you don't end up from a thriving, happy marriage to on the brink, right? Like that doesn't happen. That is a slow, generally, some people, it is a cataclysmic event, but for most people, it is a year after year of not prioritizing that relationship, just kind of living with the assumption of that relationship. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you've kind of drifted apart. I often think that marriages that don't make it oftentimes is because of the drift and not because of some cataclysmic event. And so that reminds us, it's the new year is a great time to remind all of us who are married out there to go, okay, what are you going to do to make sure you don't drift away from your spouse in 2022? What are you going to do to lean in, to be intentional, to because it's not just about that, that we just got married kind of bliss and love like that. That does wear off, but it gets replaced. If you work at it, it gets replaced by just this depth of relationship. I know I've heard other people say this, right? Like the saying is the grass is always greener on the other side, when in reality, we should be saying like, I need to then work to make the grass on my side better.
Yes, like the grass is greener where you water it.
There
yes.
you go. There yes. you go. And so I think that's helpful. And again, Aubrey, there are cataclysmic events that have to be dealt with in this net. But I think for the vast majority of us, it's how do I not just let this thing drift in a bad direction?
Yeah, I think that's really good. I think the reason Brian and I are like, we sound like we're sort of, I don't know, hedging our bets is because we know like pastors in general have erred on the side of telling women who've been abused or been cheated on time and time again, like stay in the marriage at all costs. That is not what Brian and I are saying. Mm-hmm. Brian and I are saying there are definitely circumstances where the Lord releases you from your marriage. But what we are saying is, look, when life gets tough, when marriage gets tough, you got to fight for what you mm-hmm. want. And at the end of the day, long term, like there's a reward of deep friendship and intimacy and joy in a marriage that comes from doing the work to stay in and to not quit mm-hmm. and to not give up.
Amen.
Brian, very, very briefly, because we only have a little bit of time left, but over at Focus on the Family, Julie Holmquist wrote an article about how to stay married when life is tough. And she says, keep paddling. Here's what she says. Don't blame each other. bear the annoyances, don't quit, rely on God's word, and enjoy your reward. I feel like mm-hmm. that's a good word for all of us who are in a relationship where maybe we feel a little bit annoyed, but we want to keep going, don't you?
Amen. Amen. The more resources you can take in, the more work you can do, it's watering the grass, as you said. So we'd encourage you to do that.
All right. Well, coming up next, Brian, you and I are going to talk about six characteristics of pastors that deserve to be followed. I hope this is a refreshing list for all of us. You're listening to The Common Good on AM 1160. Hope for your life. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Common Good. My name is Aubrey Sampson alongside my co-host, Brian Fromm. And it is the end of a show. And at the end of every show, we absolutely love to give you something inspiring, encouraging, or challenging to think about. Brian, I was over at churchleaders.com reading an article about characteristics of a pastor who deserves to be followed. And look, I know not all of our listeners are pastors, but I know a lot of our listeners are pastors or are churchgoers or are Christians. So I feel like this is just a good word for all of us, pastors who deserve to be followed. And let's just say up front, you know, it's not on this list.
What's that?
Big platform and celebrity.
That's right. That's
this right. is about the heart, which I appreciate. Okay, so let's talk about some of these things. But before we do, Brian, what are characteristics you look for in a pastor that you would say that pastor deserves to be followed?
Yep. I think I think an important thing about this list is the recognition that we do have to earn the right to be followed. Like it talks about the pastor who deserves, a lot of us just think I have the title, follow me. And that's not the case. And so I think that's important. You know, I think if I were looking for a church or a pastor to follow, it's weird. It goes back to what I said earlier when we talked about what's the word of your year. I would think I would want to see somebody who's had a steadiness about them.
Yep.
I would want a steadiness and not somebody who, you know, you could tell when somebody is also like about themselves. Like I want somebody who's a shepherd.
Yeah.
And that has a, you know, if they have a family, I'd want to, you know, a family that I respect, not a perfect family, but a family that I would aspire to, you know, emulate. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, character just plays a huge deal. Like I think
absolutely. And
that's where the steadiness comes from. I want to be, as best as possible. This, you can never do this perfectly. I don't want to be surprised, right? When I get that email from the church that says, your pastor, did X or Y. Again, we've all been surprised by people.
Yeah.
And so there's that, but those are some of them for me. I think a lot of mine are going to be character and steadiness and the rest will go from there.
Yeah. So Brian, I would agree. And this is probably just another nuance of exactly what you're saying. But for me, like I want to see long-term integrity. And that's what I want for myself. Like I want to know that this pastor has run the race for a long while, has been through some hard stuff, but is still just faithfully following Jesus and loving their family. And it's so funny when I think about that, because when I think about my own pastoring or even Kevin's pastoring, I tend to think, oh, I need to be this and this and this and dynamic and leadership skills and be able to, you know, I know the map of discipleship from A to Z and I'm going to get everybody there. And like, I feel this pressure to be and do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm actually looking for the pastor that I want to follow, it's simply someone who has run the race for a long while in a faithful way.
Yes.
Period.
Or they're young, but you have confidence they are going to run the race for a while. Like you can, you all know those people, right? Like you've had people alongside you who might be in their mid 20s, early 30s, but you're like, I'm not worried that they're going to veer off. I'm not worried that this pastor is going to throw away their faith or you know what? Like, so yes, I want somebody who has that track record or that I have confidence that's going to be their story, because I don't think the answer is only look for pastors in their 60s.
Right.
But it is, you can tell, you can, we know that you can tell, not with 100% certainty, but there is something to be said about, a trajectory. And so I think it's hugely important.
I think kind of along that lines, Kevin and I learned a really terrible lesson very early on in our ministry. So we were both in our 20s, but I was leading a junior high ministry at the time, and we were involved in some leadership things at the church. And we raised up a young guy, a very young 20s, because he was charismatic and because he was a good speaker and he seemed like a person of character. Well, what we discovered is he truly, truly wasn't. He was committing private criminal behavior at home. It was awful, awful, awful.
Yeah,
he's been in jail since then. But here's the big lesson that we learned, because you're right. You can have young, you can raise up young people and follow young people in leadership. When he came to our church, there were no, there was no community around him. Like there weren't people in his life that could affirm, yes, he has been a good leader for a long time. And so I think even if you're, yes, of course, the Lord anoints young people all the time, their community, their family, the people around them need to be able to affirm that. And that helps you know, okay, they're not in a bubble just like looking like a good leader. They actually have proven leadership, humility. Anyway, I like that. Okay, so here's the characteristics, Brian. Maybe you and I could talk about where we need to grow and maybe where we're actually doing okay. If it's okay for pastors to say that, I guess is the
question. So,
All right, so again, this is over at churchleaders.com. Six characteristics of a pastor who deserves to be followed. One, impeccable character, what you and I have just talked about. Two, deep down biblical humility. Three, a walk with God that lends credibility to their vision casting. Four, demonstrated love and devotion to their churches with no sense of ownership or entitlement. Five, inspires others with a faith and enthusiasm that is long-term and genuine. Six, has demonstrated skill in the nuts and bolts aspects of leadership.
That's good.
So, Brian, do any of these stand out to you as like, okay, I could grow in this in my pastoring? And do any of these stand out to you as like, actually, I think like the Lord has helped me in this area?
Yeah. One that I think I read and I went, oh, yeah, I could use some help in that one was number four, demonstrated love and devotion to their church with no sense of ownership. And
I thought the same thing. Okay. Tell me why.
I have love and devotion for my church, but I mean, if I'm just being honest, I started the church, right? Like I've been here longer than anybody. Yeah. I often think of this as my church and not as in like it should give me things or it should be whatever I want it to be. It's just I have like this personal ownership in the church that it's hard not to. I do. I have a. I hopefully I don't have a sense of entitlement, but he says, but that ownership of these are my people. This is my church. This is what that's a difficult one. So I
struggled
with that
one. What's the downside of that? Because I actually do think you're right. Like the Lord has given you that those sheep to shepherd.
Yeah.
So what's the shadow side of like, these are my people, my church, I have ownership over them.
Then I become the ceiling for everything, every decision, every vision, every this and that. And I don't feel the freedom at some point, whether it be a year from now or 50 years or 30 years from now, to move on, right?
Yeah.
Because then it's my church. And so it all becomes about the person in charge. And that is the founder syndrome, right? You and I both started churches. Like we talk about founder syndrome, where it's just about the founder and that churches have to break out of that. And so there are people in my church who are better at leading in certain areas than I am. So if I'm the back, if I'm the pipeline for everything, then we're going to have a really low ceiling in some areas. We'll have a higher ceiling in other areas, but we'll have a low ceiling. And so it can't, it's got to be God's church, right?
Yeah, and it has to be God's
yes,
church.
Yes, absolutely. Which would stand out to you?
I would say I'll just affirm and agree. Yes, I felt that as well, especially after 2020, 2021. I think for me, I definitely had a sense of entitlement, like people who left our church, you know, because of whatever in COVID, we want to give a name to all that craziness, but I would be like, how dare they leave our church? That to me felt like entitlement. That to me was like a little bit like, oh, wait, do I think this is my kingdom or Jesus' kingdom? So
yes,
I would say that's definitely one. And then, you know, an area that I feel like I hope is that I have inspired our church with faith and enthusiasm that's long-term and genuine. Like, I hope I show my church, like, look, I still love Jesus. I'm still passionate about the local church and about the kingdom of God. But genuine, like, also I show them when I struggle and when it's hard and when I've had difficult times. I hope they see that inspiration and authenticity in me.
Yeah, I think it's that's our all of our hope, right? Like we want our churches to get that from us. So it's always good to look, what am I doing well? What am I doing poorly? And kind of lean into those things.
Yep, that's good. Well, we hope that encourages you, whether you're a pastor or just somebody following Jesus or somebody looking for a pastor. You can find those six characteristics of pastors that deserve to be followed over at churchleaders.com. And thanks so much for joining us today. We'll be back again tomorrow from 4 to 6 p.m. For Brian Fromm, I'm Aubrey Sampson, and you've been listening to The Common Good on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.